Answer to the question, what is enlightenment? 1784, Immanuel Kant. Enlightenment is man's exit from his self-incurred minority. Minority is the incapacity to use one's intelligence without the guidance of another. Such minority is self-incurred if it is not caused by a lack of intelligence, but by a lack of determination and courage to use one's intelligence without being guided by another. Have the courage to use your own intelligence is therefore the motto of this enlightenment. Through laziness and cowardice, a large part of mankind, even after nature has freed them from alien guidance, gladly remain in minority. It is because of laziness and cowardice that it is so easy for others to usurp the role of guardians. It is so comfortable to be a minor. If I have a book which provides meaning for me, a pastor who has conscience for me, a doctor who will judge my diet for me, and so on, then I do not need to exert myself. I do not have any need to think. If I can pay, others will take over the tedious job for me. The guardians who have kindly undertaken the supervision will see to it that by far the largest part of mankind, including the entire fair sex, should consider the step into maturity not only as difficult, but as very dangerous. After having made their domestic animals dumb, and having carefully prevented these quiet creatures from daring to take any step beyond the lead strings to which they have fastened them, these guardians then show them the danger which threatens them should they attempt to walk alone. Now, this danger is not really so very great, for they would presumably learn to walk after some stumbling. However, an example of this kind intimidates and frightens people out of all further attempts. It is difficult for the isolated individual to work himself out of the minority, which has become almost natural for him. He has even become fond of it, and for the time being is inescapable of employing his own intelligence, because he has never been allowed to make a single attempt. Statutes and formulas, these mechanical tools of a serviceable use, or rather misuse, of his natural faculties, are the ankle chains of a perpetual minority. Whoever threw it off would make an uncertain jump over the smallest trench because he is not accustomed to such free movement. Therefore, there are only a few who have pursued a firm path and have succeeded in escaping from minority by their own cultivation of the mind. But it is more nearly possible for a public to enlighten itself. This is even inescapable if only the public is given its freedom. For there will always be some people who think for themselves, even among the self-appointed guardians of the great mass, who, after having thrown off the yoke of minority themselves, will spread about them the spirit of a reasonable estimate of their own value and of the need for every man to think for himself. It is strange that the very public, which had previously been put under this yoke by the guardians, forces the guardians thereafter to keep it there, if it is stirred up by a few of its guardians who are themselves incapable of all enlightenment. It is thus very harmful to plant prejudices, because they come back to plague those very people who themselves, or whose predecessors, have been the originators of these prejudices. Therefore, a public can only arrive at enlightenment slowly, through revolution, the abandonment of personal despotism may be engendered, and the end of profit-seeking and domineering oppression may occur, but never a true reform of the state of mind. Instead, new prejudices, just like the old ones, will serve as the guiding reins of the great unthinking mass. All that is required for this enlightenment is freedom, and particularly the least harmful of all that may be called freedom, namely the freedom for man to make public use of his reason in all matters. But I don't hear people clamor on all sides, don't argue. The officer says, don't argue, drill. The tax collector, don't argue, pay. The pastor, don't argue, believe. Only a single lord in the world says, argue as much as you want to and about what you please, but obey. Here we have restrictions on freedom everywhere. Which restriction is hampering enlightenment, and which does not, or even promotes it? I answer, the public use of a man's reason must be free at all times, and this alone can bring enlightenment among men. While the private use of a man's reason may often be restricted rather narrowly, without thereby unduly hampering the progress of enlightenment. I mean by the public use of one's reason, the use which a scholar makes of it before the entire reading public. Private use I shall call the use which he may make of this reason in a civic post or office. For some affairs, which are in the interest of the Commonwealth, a certain mechanism is necessary through which some members of the Commonwealth must remain purely passive in order that an artificial agreement with the government for the public good be maintained, or so that at least the destruction of the good be prevented. In such a situation, it is not permitted to argue. One must obey. But insofar as this unit of the machine considers himself a member of the entire Commonwealth, in fact, even of a world society, in other words, he considers himself in the quality of a scholar who is addressing the true public through his writing, he may indeed argue without the affairs suffering for which he is employed partly as a passive member. Thus, it would be harmful, very much so, if an officer who, given an order by a superior, should start, while in the services, to argue concerning the utility or the appropriateness of that command. He must obey, but he cannot equitably be prevented from making observations as a scholar concerning the mistakes in the military service, nor from submitting these to the public for its judgment. The citizen cannot refuse to pay the taxes imposed upon him. Indeed, a rash criticism of such taxes, if they are the ones to be paid by him, must be punished as a scandal which might cause general resistance. But the same man does not act contrary to the duty of a citizen if, as a scholar, he utters publicly his thoughts against the undesirability or even the injustice of such taxes. Likewise, a clergyman is obliged to teach his pupils and his congregation according to the creed of the church which he serves, for he has been accepted on that condition. But as a scholar, he has full freedom, in fact, even the obligation to communicate to the public all his diligently examined and well-intentioned thoughts concerning an erroneous point in the doctrines, and concerning proposals regarding the better institution of religious and ecclesiastical manners. There is nothing in this for which the conscience should be blamed. For what he teaches according to his office as one authorized by the church, he presents as something in regard to which he has no latitude to teach according to its own preference. He will say, our church teaches this or that. These are the proofs which are employed for it. In this way, he derives all possible practical benefit for his congregation from rules which he would not himself subscribe to with full conviction. But he may nevertheless undertake the presentation of these rules because it is not entirely inconceivable that the truth may be contained in them. In any case, there is nothing directly contrary to inner religion to be found in such doctrines. For, should he believe that the latter was not the case, he could not administer his office in good conscience. He would have to resign it. Therefore, the use which an employed teacher makes of his reason before his congregation is merely a private use, since such a gathering is always only domestic, no matter how large. As a priest, a member of an organization, he is not free and ought not be free, since he is executing someone else's mandate. On the other hand, the scholar speaking through his writings to the true public, which is the world, like the clergyman making public use of his reason, enjoys an unlimited freedom to employ his own reason and to speak in his own person. For to suggest that the guardians of the people in spiritual manner should always be immature minors is a nonsense which would mean perpetuating forever existing nonsense. But should a society of clergymen, for instance, an ecclesiastical assembly, be entitled to commit itself by oath to a certain unalterable doctrine, in order to perpetuate an endless guardianship over each of its members, and through them over the people? I answer that this is quite inconceivable. Such a contract, which would be concluded in order to keep humanity forever from all further enlightenment, is absolutely impossible. Even should it be confirmed by the highest authority through parliaments and the most solemn peace treaties. An age cannot conclude a pact and take an oath upon it to commit the succeeding age to a situation in which it would be impossible for the latter to enlarge even its most important knowledge, to eliminate error, and altogether to progress in enlightenment. Such a thing would be a crime against human nature, the original destiny of which consists in such progress. Succeeding generations are entirely justified in discarding such decisions as unauthorized and criminal. The touchstone of all this, to be agreed upon as a law for people, is to be found in the question whether a people could impose such a law upon itself. Now it might be possible to introduce a certain order for a definite short period, as if in anticipation of a better order. This would be true if one permitted at the same time each citizen, and especially the clergyman, to make his criticisms in his quality as a scholar, i.e. through the writings that make remarks about what is defective in the current arrangements. In the meantime, the provisional order might continue until the insight into the particular matter in hand has publicly progressed to the point where, through a combination of voices, although perhaps not all, a proposal may be brought to the crown. Thus, those congregations would be protected which had agreed to a changed religious institution, according to their own ideas and better understanding, without hindering those who desire to allow the old institutions to continue. But to unite on a persisting constitution that is not to be publicly doubted by anyone, even within the lifetime of a human being, and thereby to prevent the progress of humanity, this can only be disadvantageous to posterity and is absolutely impermissible. A man may postpone for himself, but only for a short time, enlightening himself regarding what he ought to know. But to resign from such enlightenment altogether, either for his own person, or even more for his descendants, means to violate and to trample underfoot the sacred rights of mankind. Whatever a people may not decide for themselves, a monarch may even less decide for the people. For his legislative reputation rests upon his uniting the entire people's will in his own. If the monarch will only see to it that every true or imagined reform of religion fits in with the civil order, he had best let his subjects do what they consider necessary for the sake of their salvation. That is not his affair. His only concern is to prevent one subject from hindering another by force, to work according to each subject's best ability to determine and to promote his salvation. In fact, it detracts from his majesty if he interferes in such matters, and subjects to government supervision the writings by which his subjects seek to clarify their ideas concerning religion. This is true whether he does it from his own highest insight, for in the case he exposes himself to the reproach, César non est supra grammaticos, it is even more true when he debases his highest power to support the highest despotism of some tyrants in his state against the rest of his subjects. The question may now be put, do we live at present in an enlightened age? The answer, no, but in an age of enlightenment. Much still prevents men from being placed in a position, or even being placed into position, to use their own minds securely and well in matters of religion. But we do have very definite indications that this field of endeavor is being opened up for men to work freely and reduce gradually the hindrances preventing a general enlightenment and an escape from self-caused immaturity. In this sense, this age is the age of enlightenment and the age of Frederick the Great. A prince should not consider it beneath him to declare that he believes it is his duty not to prescribe anything to his subjects in matters of religion, but to leave them to complete freedom in such things. In other words, a prince who refuses a conceited title of being tolerant is himself enlightened. He deserves to be praised by his grateful contemporaries and descendants as the man who first freed humankind of minority. at least as far as the government is concerned, and who permitted everyone to use his own reason in all matters of conscience. Under this rule, venerable clergymen could, regardless of their official duty, set forth their opinions and views, even though they differ from the accepted creed here and there. They could do so in the quality of scholars, freely and publicly. The same holds even more true of every other person who is not thus restricted by official duty. This spirit of freedom is spreading even outside the country of Frederick the Great to places where it has to struggle with the external hindrances posed by a government which misunderstands its own position. I have emphasized the main point of enlightenment, that is, of man's release from his self-incurred minority, primarily in matters of religion. I have done this because our rulers have no interest in playing the guardian of their subjects in matters of arts and sciences. Furthermore, minority in matters of religion is not only most noxious, but also most dishonorable. But the point of view of a head of state who favors freedom in the arts and sciences goes even farther, for he understands that there is no danger in legislation permitting his subjects to make public use of their own reason and to submit publicly their thoughts regarding a better framing of such laws together with a frank criticism of existing legislation. We have a shining example of this. No prince excels him whom we admire. Only he who is himself enlightened does not fear specters when he at the same time has a well-disciplined army at his disposal as a guarantee of public peace. Only he can say what the ruler of a free state dare not say. Argue as much as you want, and about whatever you want, but obey. Thus we see here, as elsewhere, an unexpected turn in human affairs, just as we observe that almost everything therein is paradoxical. A great degree of civil freedom seems to be advantageous for the freedom of the spirit of the people, and yet it establishes impassable limits. A lesser degree of such civil freedom provides additional space in which the spirit of a people can develop to its full capacity. Therefore, nature has cherished, within its hard shell, the germ of the inclination and the need for free thought. This free thought gradually acts upon the mind of the people, and they gradually become more capable of acting in freedom. Eventually, the government is also influenced by this free thought, and thereby it treats man, who is now more than a machine, according to his dignity.